This week on the Kickstarter podcast, we talked to political cartoonist Ted Rall about comics journalism and his project to go back to Afghanistan. Ted Rall is not afraid to speak his mind. It's a quality that's earned him plenty of critics who've called him, among other things, a vicious, conspiracy-minded, hate-filled jerk and a revolting, minimally talented, grossly misinformed deviant. If you've seen any of his Pulitzer-nominated editorial cartoons in the past, syndicated in newspapers around the world, you might agree, depending on your political leanings. You'd know he tends to drop comics like atomic bombs, tackling subjects in the most direct and often confrontational way that he can. He's been accused by both the left and right of being deliberately controversial, but he prefers to think of it as just being direct. When you only have four panels in a comic, every word that you say matters, every line that you draw makes a difference. But his books, documenting his trips to Central Asia and Afghanistan, are totally different. They're often just as direct, but with more breathing room, he can cover the day-to-day experience of living life as a New York cartoonist stuck in one of the most dangerous places on Earth. It's unlike any war reporting I've ever read, a mix of written dispatches, short cartoons, and long-form graphic novel. His earlier trips were funded by major media companies, but in the current media landscape, that's no longer an option. So after he discovered Kickstarter, Ted Rall decided to try funding his next trip directly from his fans. He's raising $15,000 to go back to Afghanistan to write his 15th book, this time covering life through the eyes of the Afghan people. You've written about how your first trip to Central Asia back in 97 was inspired by a childhood dream, how you'd been reading National Geographic about the most remote places on Earth, and then you grew up and you actually went there. And your 2001 trip that you documented into Afghanistan and back, that was inspired by America's response to 9/11. So my first question is, what is inspiring you to go back now?
The surge, mainly. I was not surprised, but yet disappointed that Obama decided to send more troops to Afghanistan. He said he was going to during the campaign. I thought that when he became president, he would hear about the situation on the ground and decide not to do that. But he's going ahead anyway. And, you know, it's kind of a mirror image of what happened in 2001. In 2001, when the war began in late September, early October, I sat at home and I had been there before and I'd been to Afghanistan, I'd been to Central Asia. And I just didn't recognize much about what I heard or saw on television. You know, it just didn't jive with what I knew to be true. And that's why I was kind of dying to get in there and see things for myself. And now it's sort of the same thing. A lot of the coverage that we see just seems to have so little relation to what I know or think to be true that I really wanted to return and see what the situation is like now. I mean, we're talking about a country that is moving so fast, changing so fast, province by province, town by town. I could be wrong, you know, and but at the same time, so this is about filling in a lot of gaps. It's about filling in the difference between how Afghanistan felt in the fall of 2001 and how it feels today. It's about the difference between the places that have been covered extensively by the media, which are mainly in and around Kabul and also certain hot zones like Helmand Province. But Afghanistan is a vast country, and there are whole swaths of the country that never have seen an American or Western reporter that I'd like to see. And then finally, there's a personal aspect to this, which is that I'm very worried about my fixer and his family, because they did help Americans, and the area that he lives in is now under Taliban control. And I feel like I owe him my life, and I want to go there and help him and say hello and see how he's doing and just reconnect with him. So there's personal reasons, there's personal curiosity reasons. And I also think that there's, and of course there's a political reason, because I am a very political person, and I believe that if more Americans knew what was really going on and they were getting the facts from unembedded reporters who were not beholden to the military for their personal safety, they even more against the war than they are today. I say even because most Americans are opposed to the war in Afghanistan. But I think it would be, it's sort of a 50-50 split. I think it's like 52-48, but it would tip more. And that could prompt our political leaders to bring our troops home sooner, which would just be better for them and for us and, of course, for the Afghans.
You said you mentioned you're going to be visiting your fixer and his family. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the fixer for a journalist?
Well, a fixer is literally in a war zone, the difference between life and death. It's a very weird, informal arrangement. The way I got Joveed was that he was waiting with a bunch of other would-be fixers at the Tajik-Afghan border. On November 15th, 2001, at 2 o'clock in the morning. And all of us reporters who were in a convoy of 45 people, ranging from all over the world, TV, radio, and press, were greeted by these guys who were all yelling at us, "Hire us, hire us." And, you know, we don't know these guys. Most of them didn't speak English. You know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning in Afghanistan. So, you know, they sort of followed, they kind of like attached themselves like limpets to their favorite reporters. And I had like 3-4 guys who were vying for me to hire them. And I kind of realized very quickly that I would need to just rely on my instincts as to what, you know, what I needed someone to do. And the way that they market themselves is as translators. But it's kind of funny because a lot of them don't really speak English very well at all. And actually, you don't really need them as translators. What you really need is people who will pull you out of a bad situation, and ideally people who know people all over. So if you're going to go to Mazar-e-Sharif and you say, "Hey, I'd like to go to Mazar-e-Sharif," if the guy says, "Oh, my brother lives there, we can stay with him," that's a huge selling point. Because, you know, you don't want to stay in a hotel. You don't want to stay, you know, anywhere public. You always want to keep your head down. Or if someone says, you know, it's about what they can do for you. If I can connect you with the right car to go where you want to go. It's like, really? You have a Soviet pickup truck? That's great. That's just what I want. Or you have an SUV? That's what I want. And so, you know, you sort of feel these guys out. And then also, a lot of these guys were kind of liars. You know, you got some of them had connections to the insurgency, to the Taliban. And, you know, you got the sense that they would sell you out and have you robbed and killed by their friends. So you're trying to figure out, you know, which of these guys can help me and not hurt me. And but like once that relation, it took about a week for me to really settle on Joveed. And what I liked about him was he never lied to me. And the other guys, they all lied. They all lied to me. I mean, not about things that I cared about. Like one guy said that he had never been in the Taliban, and I found out that he had been. Well, you know, I didn't care. But if he, you know, if he could lie to me about that, what else is he lying to me about? So, but Joveed was honest, and he was also a little soft and wimpy in a very martial society.
You said dorky in the book.
Yeah, he was dorky. I mean, he looked. Like all Afghans, much older than he was. He was 21. He looked like you would say he was in his mid to late 40s if you met him here. But he was, I remember talking to his father. His father was a tailor. He had a little shop. And I talked to him and he said, you know, I was really disappointed with Joveed. I wanted him to join a good militia. And he just didn't want to go that way. He doesn't like guns. He just wanted to, he's more of a scholar and studies English. And I thought, you know, I appreciate that. That's pretty cool. And it was funny. I went to Afghanistan that time with my wife and my agent. And they were both complaining about Joveed because he smelled terrible. he had like the worst BO. And, you know, in a small room in Afghanistan, that can really, you know, that can really get to you. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, my fault. I offered to pay for the hammam money to have him take a bath, but he just, whatever, he was pocketing the money, extra money. And, but anyway, despite all his flaws, you know, I mean, I just had a good feeling about him. And when the crunch came, which is, you know, the night I wrote about it in the book, but the night that, the soldiers, Northern Alliance soldiers, were going around door to door to all of us journalists trying to get us to open the door. And one guy from Sweden did open the door, and they shot him and killed him and robbed him, in that order. And we knew they were hunting us to kill us. And we knew when we woke up that morning, one of my neighbors came and said they killed the Swede. And so I, you know, got Joe Veed and I said, we need a Soviet pickup truck. I want you to invite all of your friends who need a ride, to go with us. And we're going to ride in the back. And I want you to get the crappiest localist looking truck you can. And we're hightailing it to the border. And other reporters were making similar arrangements. And I was very impressed with how quickly Jovid pulled it all together. And when we did get ambushed and we did take fire, he was so brave. It was, you know, amazing. And he got us to the border. A good fixer can and does mean the difference between life and death. Some reporters choose not to use them at all. But you need, in a place like Afghanistan, it's about someone who can get you hidden, someone who can get you in and out of situations, get you to meet people. And in places like dictatorships, like Central Asia, it's someone who can grease the skids, bribe the right official to get the permit that you need to do to go to the place you need to go. If there's a crunch and you need a plane ticket on a plane that's sold out, he can arrange for someone else's reservation to be canceled and get you on that flight. It's literally a fixer is a person who fixes things up for you.
I was surprised in the book how unsavvy it seemed that some of the major media was, especially in things like haggling and the amount of money that they would spend, but also where they would choose to stay. Is that just chalked up to unfamiliarity with the region, or do they just have too much money, or what's the issue there?
Well, those two things are absolutely the case. They have too much money, and they get parachuted into a place that they don't know anything about. But also, they're idiots. I mean, one great story, and I think it's in the book, is when we first arrived in Afghanistan across the Tajik border, there were those, I told you, you know, as I talked about all the fixers. Well, there were also people who wanted to drive us. And they said, okay, you have to get to Dashti Kala. It's the next town in. You can't stay here at the border outpost. And it was like 2 a.m. And so all the Afghans are like, you know, offering their rides to American and other reporters. And I remember like this ABC news team, like paying, and you know, they said, oh, these guys will take us for $1,200. And it's like, but, you know, and they're like, oh, but we'll, you know, I got them down to $1,000. I'm like, $1,000 for a ride? And it's like, you know, we're talking about a part of the world where you should be able to go 50 miles for a dollar. And so I asked some of the Afghans, you know, where's Dashti Kala? How many kilometers is it? And they said, it's 12. I said, and I was like, screw that. I'll walk. It's like, I have feet. They go, you can't walk. I go, are you kidding? I was like, I came 12 and a half time zones around the world. I banged through southern Tajikistan. I can wait till morning and I can walk. It's 8 miles. No problem. And they were like shocked at this, right? So one by one, all the other reporters paid no less than $400 and as high as $1,200 to go on this little 12-kilometer ride to Dashti Kala, where there was a warlord's guest house. And to spend the night, not much of the night since we all got rousted at 6 a.m. So anyway, I was last and, you know, my wife and my agent were kind of angry at me because I was haggling so ferociously that I got the guy to agree to $40 and off we went. And I was still pissed off about it because I thought $40 is way too much, but okay, fine. It's 4 a.m. now. Right. So anyway, we get there in like, I don't know, 20, maybe 30 minutes. We arrive there. It's empty. It's just us. There's an old guy with a beard. He lets us in, sets us up in a room. And, you know, I jammed a chair up against the door and we went to sleep. And like a couple hours, like maybe an hour later, now it's like 5, we hear this ruckus and we hear Western voices. So I went out and talked to them. And it was all these guys from ABC and all these other companies who had come, who had paid like all this money and who had left hours before us. I said, where have you guys been? They said, well, we just got here. It's a long drive. I said, what are you talking about? about? I go, he goes, what do you mean? I go, it's just like a short little jaunt. He goes, no, we went through mountains. We went through a pass. I'm like, so obviously what happened was that the Afghans drove them in circles through the mountains in order to justify the money. And, you know, things like this happened over and over again. There were also, you know, ethical concerns. I mean, they would literally, you know, not have any B-roll for the evening news. So they would go to a place where a battle was at a standstill, which is mostly what happens in war. There's just two sides staring at each other across a field, and nothing's going on. No one's firing at anyone. But, you know, the reporters really need some B-roll. So they were paying anywhere from $300 to $500 per shell to have these big guns fired so they'd have something dramatic to show on the evening news, even though there's no war, there's no battle going on. And, you know, there were ethical concerns, too. Like, they would the big networks stayed with the warlords in their house, in their compounds. And, you know, I was living in the hood with the locals. And aside from being jealous of the fact that the TV networks had running water and flush toilets and armed guards, you know, courtesy of the local commanders, I was also really kind of furious about it. And I thought, you know, these guys are getting this insulated view. They're not reporters, you know? I mean, they're not really getting the story. How could they? And, you know, they would go every day to some pre-packaged press conference and listen to, you know, just a bunch of nonsense. And I learned a lot more just by going to the bazaar and shopping and talking to locals who had just come from somewhere. And they could tell me much more quickly what was really going on. And, you know, I'm not a real reporter. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a professional journalist. I didn't go to J school. I've done it just by doing it for a long time. But these guys are, you know, they're working at major TV networks. They work at the Washington Post and the New York Times. They should be a million times better than me. And they were singularly unimpressive. I mean, they were sometimes very brave and smart people, but they didn't really know much about what they were doing. They wouldn't even really know the geography of the place where they were. They wouldn't know, you know, exactly where, like, if you head north, what town you're going to hit. They didn't know where they were. It was weird.
The first book was written entirely from your perspective, so it was a lot of these stories of what life as a journalist in Afghanistan is like. You said in your first Kickstarter project update, you said you're planning on this time focusing on the stories of the Afghan people, telling it through their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much looking at the Joe Sacco approach to this, which is giving voice to the voiceless, which is something I feel like I do a lot, and I did to some extent in the first book. But this time, it's not, you know, the first book was really like a fish out of water story. It's like Midwestern kid goes to Afghanistan, bad things happen. This is more about reporting back to the American people what it's like to live in Afghanistan and to be an Afghan in the summer of 2010, depending on who and where I'm talking about. I want to know, you know, what their concerns are, their hopes, their fears, their everyday lives. It's, you know, this is much more about seeing it from their point of view as much as possible. Like I did last time, I'll interview lots of people, but it's going to be about putting their voices first instead of my voice first. And, you know, it's hard to know what I'm going to find. I mean, obviously, if I knew what I was going to find, I wouldn't have to go. But, you know, assuming that I pull this off, it's going to be, you know, I think that's what the American people need to know. They need to hear from the people of Afghanistan. And I don't think it's just an Afghan thing. I mean, there's a metaphor here for U.S. foreign policy that applies really to U.S. involvement in all countries. You know, for instance, now we don't hear much from the Haitian people. You know, we hear a lot from Americans who are in Haiti and other Westerners who are in Haiti, but we don't hear what the Haitians themselves would want or would have wanted from the disaster response. And that's wrong. It's their country. And Afghanistan, as damaged as it is their country. It's not ours. And we should be doing what they want, not what we want.
Another thing that I thought was really fascinating about To Afghanistan and Back was your choice of formats, which I know was partially dictated by the work that you were doing for KFI and the Village Voice at the time. You know, it's a graphic novel. It's these prose dispatches, photographs, and then interspersed with the 4-panel editorial cartoons, you know, you're most famous for. What are you thinking about for the new book?
I think the new book is going to be more integrated. The format I have in mind is a reporter's notebook, maybe even in the format with the lined paper, maybe even handwritten, where what happens is tied in very closely. Like, for instance, if I mention someone who I met and talked to, their photo will be right there instead of maybe somewhere else. If I do a cartoon that comes out of it, it's not that I'll talk about the cartoon in the prose and then show it. So everything will be far more linear instead of sort of, to Afghanistan and back, I mean, the best thing about it is the fact that it's so immediate. You can almost taste the dust between your teeth when you read it. But it's really a slapdash affair. I mean, it was cobbled together in 6 quick weeks when I was still in pretty, you know, not in ideal emotional or physical shape. And so it was like, it definitely has that feel of like sort of being cobbled together in a hurry. And I guess that maybe adds to the immediacy, but I don't want to do that this time. This time I want it to be far more planned out. And I think also it's probably going to be a prettier format. It's probably going to be full color. You know, it depends on who the publisher is. I've done some mock-ups of what I think it'll look like, and it'll probably still be the same insofar as it's going to have those same elements: photos, comics, dispatches, and cartoons. But the way that they're put together is going to be more linear and sensical.
Are you going to do any sort of longer form graphic novella like you did in the first?
I don't know. I'm going to sort of see how it goes. I was thinking that one thing I might do differently is to sort of do long form editorial cartoons instead of like the graphic novella. So maybe like tell the story of what happens in prose, but then do the background stuff that needs to be explained in like multi-panel comics. So for instance, one of the things I want to look into is the Trans-Afghanistan Oil Pipeline Project, which has just commenced construction and no one's really reporting on. It's like if people are wondering what I'm talking about, it's this, you know, Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 touches upon it briefly, but there's a long-standing plan that goes back to the mid-90s to run an oil and gas pipeline from Turkmenistan to Pakistan via Afghanistan. And, well, they're finally building it. And it was one of the reasons that we invaded in the first place in 2001 to do that project. And they're actually building it north of Herat now. So the point is, I think it would be cool to have like maybe a 8 or 10 page history of the Trans-Afghanistan Pipeline Project cartoon, maybe to set that up and then get into, you know, what's going on now.
Your previous trips were all funded by traditional news and magazine publishers, right?
Yeah. It used to, I can't say that it was easy, but it wasn't hard. If anything, they had a hard time finding people who were willing to go. You know, you could scare up, you know, 5 figures from a radio station or a, you know, like last time, if I remember the math correctly, I think KFI paid, I think, $10,000 or $15,000, and The Voice paid, I think, $12,000. And then I had syndicated columns that were filed from there that I got maybe $2,000 from there. And there were all sorts of freelance things. And so I think all told, I ended up raising about $35,000 or $40,000. And you know that it's obviously things are more expensive now, but it was. Yeah, traditional media was the way to go, and that has just dried up. I mean, it's not even a matter of being turned down. Like all of my friends who were editors at those magazines, their publications have either gone under, or they got fired. So I don't have any contacts at those magazines anymore. What we're really missing is the opportunity to do long form journalism on a freelance basis. Unless you're a huge name, it seems to be gone and maybe not coming back anytime soon. So, you know, when I heard about the Kickstarter thing, a friend of mine, a colleague, a cartoonist named Stephanie McMillan, who also has a Kickstarter project that she did, she wanted to fund a children's book with the writer Derek Jensen that she co-wrote. She told me about this, and I thought, God, that's so interesting. You know, and I thought, really, why would people want to do this? Why would they want to put up their money for, you know, to read your book or to read my thing? And she's like, well, just try it. So she gave me an invite. And you know, and I saw, obviously, when you go to the site, you see other people are doing it and are raising the money. And then I realized, you know, I guess I would do it. You know, I would support things that I want to see done. And I'm very frustrated. You know, everybody's got things they would like to see, you know, whether it's a film or a radio project or whatever, that for whatever reason, the mainstream media isn't doing. And there's all these gaps. You know, it reminds me of the film director Billy Wilder. In his last 10 or 20 years of his life, no one ever was willing to fund his movie, any movie at all. So he didn't work. And, you know, I mean, Billy Wilder is one of the greatest film directors of all time. I mean, you know, if there were a god, the government would just, like, give him money to be you're Billy Wilder. You make bad movies, whatever. You're Billy Wilder. Some, you know, the free market system doesn't always work that way. So this is you know, so far it's been very gratifying. I mean, the support has been great, and it's a really intriguing project. What I worry about is that like not every worthwhile project would get funded, or that like not, you know, every or that might not get funded. But whatever, it's a really interesting idea.
I love your rewards, copies of the book, obviously, but also the original artwork, the one-on-one meetings or like dinner and drinks, offering to do a live talk. But I think the one I like the most is the lowest one, the $10 one. It's really compelling to me. Real-time updates from Afghanistan. I imagine that is a hard place to blog from.
Yeah, there's two technological problems. One is power, lack thereof. And the other one is internet access. Now, the internet access problem is not impossible to resolve. What you do is you hook up a satellite phone to a laptop. So that's not hard. The problem is that the connection is very expensive. A satellite phone can run $7 to $14 a minute. And you're talking like old school 2400 bauds per second kind of connections. So, you know, if your email is full of spam, you're really an unhappy person. But you can blog that way. It's frustrating, and the line will drop, but you can do it. The big problem is getting power. So you have to bring all sorts of junk, heavy junk with you. There's these gadgets that are like twice the size and weight of a car battery that you can charge when you have access to power, and then you can use that to charge a laptop or a PDA from. But you have to recharge that thing, and then you can sometimes do that off a car battery if you pay a local person to like let them, you know, hook it up to give you a jump, essentially.
You said you paid a cab driver $75 to charge your phone like 25% of the way.
Exactly. Yeah, but you know that having that phone charged, you know, can save your life because you can call a fixer at the border to meet you and get you out of the country. Or, you know, if you're really in a pinch, you might call for a medevac and get a helicopter to come and get you. But that's probably, unrealistic because helicopters run like $40,000 to $50,000. So that would be a matter of life or death. But the technological challenges are huge. However, there's certain things that are much easier now than they were then. Major Afghan cities have internet access. So, you know, clearly like Kabul, Herat, Mazar, Kunduz probably should be able to – the blogging situation shouldn't be difficult from there. But when I'm out in the sticks in south, you know, by the border with Iran, there's not going to be any electricity whatsoever. You have at most, you know, 4 hours – I have a MacBook Pro. I have a spare battery. That's 4 hours of power total. And, you know, it can take you an hour to send an email. So you really have to, But yeah, that's what I promised I would do it, and I'm going to do it. There may be delays sometimes, but I think I'll be able to pull it off.
Well, $10 is such a low barrier. The funny thing about your project is that whether people love you or really hate you, either way, they should be trying to send you to Afghanistan, right?
That's true. I had several really hardcore fans, though, who said they would offer to pay me not to go. They said that it would be, that they would be very sad if something happened to me. Of course, I would be very sad if something happened to me. But, the way I look at it is millions of people live there every single day. And all I'm going to do is go there for a month.
Thanks to Ted Rall for taking the time. His project ends on April 5th, still has a ways to go. For as little as $10, get real-time updates from Afghanistan, signed copy of the book, and more. You can find his project at kck.st/TedRall or search Kickstarter for Ted. My name is Andy Bayo, and this is the Kickstarter Podcast. Thank you.